Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann here with Medical Monday. Today on the program, aging. You're planning for the future. Where will you go when you struggle to care for yourself? Your children have moved from Oklahoma. What options will you have? For many of us, it's caring for our aging parents. As a species, we live longer lifespans than ever before achieved. How should we organize our aging communities? And how should we pay for the care that elders naturally consume by virtue of the fact they need more medical care as we all become more frail? These are just some of the questions that my guest today, Fred Benjamin, wrestles with on a daily basis. Benjamin is currently Chief Operating Officer of Medical Lodges, a company based in Coffeyville, Kansas. Medical Lodges is an employee-owned provider of skilled, assisted living and home care services to the developmentally disabled that operates nearly three dozen facilities in Kansas, Missouri, and Oklahoma. Benjamin is a thought leader and advocate in the world of aging and service provision for the elderly and vulnerable. He's my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Fred Benjamin, welcome to the program. Let's start broadly. What is the Great Tsunami?
The Great Tsunami is the aging of America. We have approximately 10,000 people turning age 65 every day, and that is causing all kinds of issues within the healthcare system, meaning increased utilization, meaning people that are on Medicare now looking for providers, maybe for doctors, for everything from hospitals to nursing homes to assisted living. Although age 65 is sort of the entry point, the real entry point for people that are on Medicare is generally at about age 75 to 85 when their medical needs really start to increase.
So you're talking about, right, so 65 is when the law says you can enroll in Medicare. That's since 1965, Lyndon Johnson. But you're saying it's 75 or 80 is when people typically become frail enough to need some form of elder care. So I wanted to ask you, I'm a physician. I refer people with case management all the time, and yet the difference, the somewhat subtle differences are lost on me. So everyone kind of gets the idea of a nursing home, but let's break it down, if you will. What, you know, nursing home, assisted living, elder care, what are the specific definitions of these terms?
Okay, well, I'd like to approach that in the way of an evolutionary story, if you will.
Sure.
When I lived in Chicago, there was an area of Chicago that has a lot of tall apartment buildings near the lakefront, Sheridan Road. And one of those buildings decides that they have a lot of elderly people that live in the building. And they said, we have a couple of empty apartments now, and we're having trouble renting those. And we were thinking, you know, we might put a kitchen of some sort in and let people buy a meal plan. And said, oh, that's an interesting idea. And they do it, and it becomes successful. So then the next thing they're thinking about is, well, you know, beyond just a meal plan, it might be nice if we had some housekeeping services that we could offer to people as well. And so they put that in, and it's even more successful. And pretty soon the building's filled up. And over the course of a couple of years, people really love being in that apartment building, but they start to have medical needs. And so they decide that they're going to put a home health office in the building, and they're having nurses and therapists and all manner of assistants visit people and take care of them in their homes. In my mind's eye, that becomes an assisted living facility. And the reason that it's an assisted living facility and not a nursing home is that people have their own apartment, they have a door that locks, they have their own kitchen and are responsible for preparing their own food. If you go into a nursing home at the next level of care, at that level, you would not have a door that locked, and you would have somebody else making your food for you, and they would be preparing that food based on the doctor's order of what your nutritional needs and what your tummy could tolerate. So at that point, the government now has an interest in that relationship, and they want to monitor the quality because, generally speaking, at that point, Medicare enters the scene. Medicaid, the program for poor people, enters the system as well, and the government has a compelling need to regulate that.
That's an interesting point. So in that assisted living example that you gave, the government doesn't necessarily, it's private ownership in a sense, so there isn't a compelling interest, or who's inspecting that or making sure that, for example, that kitchen you mentioned is safe, or I guess a building inspector perhaps.
Well, now this has been an evolution of sorts. Mm-hmm. In some states, assisted living is regulated in the same way that nursing homes are regulated, that they do have inspectors that come in, but they don't have the same regulatory requirements that nursing homes have to obey.
Okay. What is a determinant of where someone will go? I suspect, obviously, it depends on their level of frailty or the medical necessity, but then also how much preference is there? So, I mean, when I've worked with families or patients, typically they want to go to the least restrictive place possible, or the one that allows them the most independence. But what goes into the calculus of that decision making?
Well, that is exactly the right answer. If you ask me, Fred, do you ever want to be in a nursing home? Not particularly, but the issue is what is a person's ability to live on their own? So the first question is regarding taking care of themselves. Can an individual make good decisions every day? Or, for example, do they get up and do they fall in the middle of the night? Are they continent? Are they able to provide for their own care on a day-to-day basis? And this is a slippery slope and also a very subtle issue. For a lot of families, when they have that conversation with grandma or grandpa at age 85, 88, 90 about grandma or grandpa's driving, maybe they were safe 6 months ago. Maybe they're not safe anymore. And those are very difficult conversations, as are making the same kinds of decisions about entering a nursing home or an assisted living facility. Generally speaking, it's an easier decision for a family to help an elderly loved one in need to go into an assisted living facility, because it's just like moving to an apartment. And a lot of times when people get to be 85 or 90, sometimes many of their friends are gone and they lack socialization during the day. So although they're able to say, well, I'm still living on my own, they don't have anybody to spend any time with during the day, and it can be a very lonely kind of lifestyle. Whereas if they move into an assisted living facility or nursing home for that matter, there are many, many kinds of activities that people have. And if you look at some of the fine facilities that are in Tulsa, there's a complete range of facilities that have assisted living only, skilled care only, or some that have assisted living and home care, and sometimes apartments with various kinds of services provided, as I described earlier.
So your company, Medical Lodges, is based in Coffeyville, Kansas, but you run about almost three dozen different facilities across Kansas, Missouri, and Oklahoma. And I'm wondering specifically just about this region of the country and the demographics. So we talked about the Great Tsunami, 10,000 Americans turning 65 every single day based on the baby boom demographic that we're expecting until the year 2029. I mean, that is a staggering reality for us. And when we talk about bending the cost curve, as it were, with the Affordable Care Act, that is chief of the concerns. So what is that evenly spread throughout the country? Are you seeing the heart of it right here in the middle of America? Is it about the same rate of aging that you would expect elsewhere? Or do you have I'm basically asking a population question, larger, smaller, same?
It's a public health question. And not surprisingly, what drives it are socioeconomic status. So people that live in large urban environments, if they're very poor, their medical needs are higher, and they require a higher level of service after they get on Medicare at an earlier age. And in our particular part of the country, our special sauce or special need, if you will, is that we have a fairly rural population. And if you look at the service offerings of Medical Lodges, we have about three quarters of our facilities that are in small rural communities. And what I was talking about just a minute ago about the lack of socialization, so many of the families that are out there living in these small communities, mom and dad stick around. They have a family farm that they've taken care of for 30, 40, 50 years and may have been inherited from their parents or grandparents before them. And all of a sudden, the only people that are left living on the farm are grandma and grandpa, and one of them passes, and there's just one person, and that person is lonely, and they don't have anybody to supervise them, and their next neighbor might be 5 or 10 miles away sometimes. And so the needs of people that are in those small rural communities are medically, pretty much the same as their urban counterparts, but their socialization needs are much greater. So we find that those folks, when they come to live in a skilled care facility, they have the same trepidation, oh, I don't want to go to a nursing home. But when they get there, the reality of it is that there are a lot of other people that sometimes they've known for many years, and they have their friends there. And it's not a bad existence for people that need to have the medical supervision, that need medical management, that need medication management, that may be a little bit forgetful and may have medical conditions that require them to be supervised by a physician and or a nurse.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Fred Benjamin. He's Chief Operating Officer of Medical Lodges, an employee-owned company based in Coffeyville, Kansas, that runs elder care and assisted living facilities for elderly folks and for disabled people in Missouri, Kansas, and in Oklahoma. And Fred, how did Medical Lodges become employee-owned, and I guess what does that represent?
Medical Lodges was founded in 1961 by the S.A. Han family. Mr. Han was a real estate developer that had an elderly mother and needed some place to have her taken care of. And he recognized that there were a lot of people in the Coffeyville, Kansas community that had a similar need, and he built Medical Lodges' first nursing home. And over a period of years, as he saw the need increasing, he built the company up to approximately 35 or 40 facilities, at one point. And in 1989, it was time for him to retire, and he sold the company to the employees in something called an ESOP, Employee Stock Ownership Program transaction, and the employees of Medical Lodges became the owners.
And so how are they represented in, like, making ownership decisions? Is there just an ownership board or employees that sit on the board of directors?
Basically, there are three trustees of the Employee Stock Ownership Program. The trustees elect Medical Lodges' board of directors, of which I'm a member, and the board of directors has responsibility basically for hiring the chief executive officer and for approving the strategic plan, and finally for monitoring something called our corporate compliance program, which is designed to make sure we're following all of the various government rules and regulations.
Now, you're based in Kansas, but in this tri-state area. So, and you are heavily involved with something called the Kansas Healthcare Association. So I'm wondering, which is really a state chapter, if you will, of the American Healthcare Association, which is really just a large trade group for nursing homes and assisted facilities. And you were telling me offline some 16,000 different organizations that are members of that. How does the Kansas chapter differ, say, from national priorities? I mean, we talked about this emphasis on farming communities and more rural villages. Does that inflect in how the Kansas chapter is different, say, from the rest of the country?
It absolutely does. And in this instance, we find great commonality with the state of Oklahoma, in that both states have had significant budget challenges over the last couple of years, with the budget shortfall in Oklahoma somewhere in the $1 billion range, and it is purported that the Kansas budget shortfall was in the area of $1.4 billion. So what you have are state governments that are financially challenged, and that in times of poor economy, such as we're in at this point, you have a competition for resources at the state level. And essentially what happens is you have the young in the school systems and the needs of school systems pitted against the needs of the elderly, which is a very difficult situation. And I don't envy our public officials, but I would remind them that a great man once said that our societies over time will be judged by how they take care of their young and their elderly.
Now, you mentioned previously that you used to live in Chicago, where you worked, really started almost, I mean, as a young man, young professional out of school in the healthcare field, and originally worked in hospital administration, or not very originally, but eventually worked in the hospital side of things. And at one point, I believe, served on something called the Illinois Health Facilities Planning Board. Now, this sounds fairly esoteric, but actually it's of interest to me because, as I understood from reading about you, that board is the one that would determine what's called a certificate of need for healthcare facilities. For example, hospitals, a community wants to build a hospital or build an addition onto a hospital or start a new cardiovascular wing or something. And so it always seemed to me to be very political in the sense that if an entity could not garner this certificate of need, they were essentially doomed and they couldn't go into business. So how did that come about? I mean, what led you to get on that Illinois Health Facilities Planning Board, and teach us a little bit about what a certificate of need is and how you go about getting one?
Well, it starts with the concept of health planning. If you take any given population and you begin to try to understand it, to dissect its components, the first thing that you would look at is, what's the age breakdown? How many people are above 65? How many are above 85? How many young women are there in the age of delivering babies? And you can go from there. You figure, well, if you have this many women that are going to deliver this many babies on average, then you can say how many delivery rooms you need, and even how many obstetricians for that matter. And then you can do the same thing for cardiovascular disease and cardiac surgery. And although the technology is constantly changing, you can get a pretty good idea of what the needs of a population are. So if you, in the example of skilled care, you can see what the number of people is, and what the planning boards of different states generally do is they create specific geographic regions called planning areas. Each of these planning areas then is identified as having so many elderly people, people over the age of 85 or 85 plus that are going to need skilled care services or assisted living services. And there are so-called bed need formulas that say how many nursing home beds are needed in a given geographic area. That's the easy part. Then comes the more difficult part. And the more difficult part, here's an example of that. You have different religious organizations that want to have a place where they can take care of people that all went to church in the same parish or all of the Jewish religion, for that matter, and they want to build their own nursing home. Well, that sure messes with the bed need formula, but it's a pretty sure thing that, generally speaking, when they do their studies, that they look and see how many people are at this point in time are going to need these services, and over a period of time, how many will need their services, and they say, look, we have a compelling need. So the question is, should we approve this application for this specific group based on their special need, or should we just go by the bed need formula? And that's where the politics enters.
So it's pretty important then, or it's incumbent upon those organizations to then prove to the facility planning board that in fact they've done at least some market research and that they're going to be able to fill their beds. Was there ever a time where you refused to issue a certificate of need? Or were, I think of the Chicago market. I used to practice there as well, and there were, you know, seven different medical schools and a, you know, vicious competition for the healthcare dollar, where these hospitals are in a competitive fight for market share. And it seems like a lot of times they're certainly not cooperating, in fact, competing against one another, and they're really trying to outgun each other for the, you know, really the same patients. So how does that all play out? I mean, I can't imagine what those are. Are those closed-door meetings?
They're absolutely not closed-door meetings. They're all public meetings that have very specific requirements. And as a matter of fact, it's illegal for more than two board members to have lunch together. Anytime three or more board members are in the same room, it's construed as a public meeting, and you can't talk about any planning board related business. That said, there clearly is it'd be naive to think that there wasn't a political dimension, and I would be lying if I said that I hadn't received telephone calls from various political officials during my tenure as chairman, asking me to consider carefully a project for a specific medical school, for example. Absolutely true. Or others that had a special kind of need. I would regard myself, though, as what I would call a strict constructionist, meaning that I found safety in trying to hew closely to the rules. And particularly in Illinois, there was an instance about 9 years ago where some planning board members ended up going to the federal prison because they didn't do it the right way.
Well, that's sort of an interesting part of your history as well, is that you were appointed and, I guess, reappointed to the Facility Planning Board by
three
different governors. Yeah. So who were those governors and where are they now?
The first governor was Jim Edgar, who went on to become the president of Eastern Illinois University. He was a Republican. The second governor was George Ryan, who knowledgeable listeners will know spent some quality time in the federal prison. And the third, of course, was Governor Rod Blagojevich, who is serving about the second half of his 14-year stint in federal prison. We like to say in Illinois, our governors make our license plates.
Well, bipartisan, but two out of three in prisons. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Fred Benjamin, Chief Operating Officer of Medical Lodges out of Coffeyville, Kansas. And we're talking about aging in America. I'm wondering what do you see coming down the pike in terms of innovation, pardon the cliche, but with caring for our elderly? Now, I have read some press about you, and you seem very knowledgeable about something called value-based purchasing or the value model for care. Now, this is, again, this interview has been fairly full of esoterica, but you've made it come to life for us. So share with us, if you will, how this affects your world. First, what is it, and then how it's going to affect your world?
Well, the long story short is that Medicare does not have enough money based on the current way that we're spending it. So, for example, if you look back over a period of years, when people were in the hospital, they used to be hospitalized in the mid-late 70s for average length of stay was 30 days.
30 days?
30 days. Average length of stay when the first law that created change in the reimbursement system, and in those days, there was something called cost plus 5, that you got all of your cost back plus 5%. Those were what we loosely call the good old days. Beyond that, when hospitals started to get paid based on something called diagnostic-related groups, or DRGs, they got paid a fixed amount of money for the entire stay that a patient had. And not surprisingly, over a period of time, the length of stay went from 30 days to 14 days to 7 days. And I believe now it's about 2 days or give or take somewhere around there.
Oh my goodness. It's all in the incentives.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, okay. So fee for service is this idea that everything that's done in healthcare has a charge associated with it. So every time a blood draw is done, every time even a blood pressure is made or a physician or healthcare provider examines you, those are billable charges. But what's different now with Medicare, and this is kind of amazing because it just seems like it couldn't possibly happen this fast, but you gave an example of how when we went to the DRG system, it happened essentially overnight. It wasn't overnight, but it was very quickly. So Medicare, Sylvia Matthews-Burwell, who is the Secretary of Health and Human Services, has said she wants, and I can't remember the number, but a 50%
80%.
Oh, wow. So 80% of all Medicare payments to be value-based. So
by 2020.
So what does this mean, and how will it affect the elder care world?
Well, basically what they're doing is they're changing the way that hospitals, physicians, skilled care, all members of the healthcare system get paid. And by changing their incentives, going from if you do more procedures in the old days, you got more money. Now, the good part of these changes is that healthcare professionals and institutions are now going to be paid to keep people well. And you can't help but think that that's going to be a good thing, because at the end of the day, that's what we really want anyways. So these value-based purchasing programs, Medicare is the driver of all of these different kinds of changes. The commercial insurance companies follow what Medicare does generally a couple of years later, because in business terms, all these different plans are risky. So they let the government figure out what they're going to do, and then they pick the more successful ones, and they imitate. So what Medicare is doing right now is they're looking at the healthcare market in a couple of different ways. So one is a disease-based or episodic-based sort of care. And the first one is something called CCJR, Comprehensive Care for Joint Replacement. So they're looking at knee replacements and hip replacements, being the most common surgical procedure that is not emergent and in nature. These procedures, needless to say, ring up a big bill for Medicare. So what Medicare is doing is they're implementing in 50 different metropolitan areas across the country the CCRJ program. And if you are a hospital or a nursing home and physician in any of these metropolitan areas, there is a single so-called bundle of payment that the hospital is going to receive. And the hospital is then going to be responsible for paying the doctor and for paying the nursing home. So if you're the hospital, you're going to say, ooh, which doctors provide the best quality, which doctors can get the patient in and out of the hospital fastest, and which nursing homes do the best job, which ones have the lowest infection rates, which ones have the lowest number of falls, and which ones can help people to get home faster. Well, that's the first phase. In the second phase, they're going to pay for the entire episode of care, and it's going to include 30 days post-discharge from skilled care or whatever. So the system is changing very rapidly. In another view of value-based payment, they're going to separate out different parts of the stay. So, for example, they might separate out the entire post-acute episode, meaning everything that happens after a person is discharged from the hospital, which might include nursing home, assisted living, home care, and various kinds of home visits to make sure that people are safe after hospitalization.
Fred Benjamin, I just want to ask a little bit about your background. That was a good explanation, by the way, but about your background. Now, we talked about how you started out in Chicago. Now, I read something where you were part of the old Mayor Daley, not the one who was most recently the mayor, but Richard J. Daley, his father. You were part of his Youth Foundation trainee program. And I lived in Chicago for almost 10 years, and I was not aware historically at that point. I don't know if his son, Richard M. Daley, ever had a program like that. How did you get picked for something like that, and what was the projects that you worked on?
This was an amazing program. Not only did I learn about how city government worked, I also got a wife out of the deal.
She was part of the program, too.
She was part of the program, too. The way that it worked was that one boy and one girl from each Chicago public high school were chosen to participate in this program, and I was fortunate, as was my wife, to be chosen. So the first year, I did this program for 4 years, and it helped put me through my undergraduate, because I was chosen for the program in my junior year of high school, and continued on through my first couple of years of undergraduate working part-time. And I worked for the Chicago Fire Department in sweeping the floor in the gymnasium the first year, and polishing the deputy commissioner's brother's car.
Oh, my goodness.
That was
humble
interesting.
Beginnings.
Humble beginnings. The next year, I worked in the laboratories, and I became a laboratory technician, which sort of fired my initial interest in healthcare. Huh. And my wife similarly worked in the commissioner's office, and in her time there, she. Well, one day she was sitting on the Civic Center Plaza under the Picasso, mm-hmm. and I walked up and introduced myself, and that was about 40 years ago.
Wow. Well, congratulations. That seems like such a good idea for a program. I mean, to take kids out of high school and to kind of, essentially teach them about civic virtue and being involved in city government. You also, you manage eventually becoming a VP of a hospital called Grant Hospital. In Lincoln Park, in a sort of now Tony neighborhood of Chicago. And you had, I read in one article about a meeting you had with a nursing home executive who essentially said to you, why do you hospital guys hate us? And that turned out to be sort of a fateful encounter for you. Tell us more about that.
Sure. It was very much an eye-opener for me because I always thought of hospitals as the good guys, as the egalitarian part of the healthcare system. And when he asked me that question, I initially didn't know what he meant. So I asked him to provide an example. And he said, well, listen, we send our patients to your hospital all the time. And you never invite us to any medical education programs. And I tried to tell him, well, that's really not how medical education works, certainly not how doctors are educated. He said, well, you get all these public funds to do medical education. You can't find any to help educate people in nursing homes. We have nurses that need education too. So I said, oh, wow, I never really thought about it that way. And the next thing that he asked me about was what the purpose of the hospital was, and if there was really we were not for profit, we don't pay real estate tax or income tax, and the conversation just sort of went on from there and became a more and more difficult conversation. And since the reimbursement system had just changed in a flash of the blindingly obvious, I said, where do a lot of sick people, old people live that need hospitalization in nursing homes? So I went and met with their management team and ultimately with the management teams of about 50 different nursing homes, nursing home companies in Chicago, and set up an affiliation program where we did exactly what they are, our customers asked us to do. We did education for them, and we had our nurses going out and doing rotations at their facilities. We had our people coming to the hospital and our subspecialty physicians in the Department of Medicine doing educational programs and luncheons for them. And these programs were very successful, and our hospital got a reputation for doing that. So it was a really good thing, and I felt very proud of that.
Well, Fred Benjamin, it's flown by. I really appreciate some of the conversation that you threw our way, that you were able to teach us about some of the changes in demographics and aging in America and your work with Medical Lodges out of Coffeyville, Kansas. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Fred Benjamin is Chief Operating Officer of Medical Lodges in Coffeyville, Kansas. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. If you've missed any of our shows, they're available online anytime from your computer or smartphone. Just check out our website, studiotulsa.org. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.